The dividing cell, cellular reproduction, and the birth of IVF. There is no such thing as reproduction. When two people decide to have a baby, they engage in an act of production. Andrew Solomon, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. A cell divides. Perhaps the most monumental event in the life cycle of a cell is the moment it gives birth to daughter cells. Not every cell is capable of reproducing. Some cells, such as some neurons, have undergone permanent or terminal division and will never divide again. But the converse is not true. Every cell is the product of birth from another cell, omnis cellula e cellula. As the French biologist François Jacob once put it, the dream of every cell is to become two cells, except, of course, those that have opted out of the dream altogether. Conceptually speaking, cell division in animals might be broadly divided into two purposes or functions, production and reproduction. By production, I mean the creation of new cells to build, grow, or repair an organism. When skin cells divide to heal a wound, when T cells divide to produce an immune response, the cells are giving birth to new cells either to produce a tissue or an organ or to fulfill a function. But it is a completely different matter when sperm or eggs are generated in the human body. Here, they are being generated to undergo reproduction, dividing to produce not a new function or an organ, but rather a new organism. In humans and multicellular organisms, the process for the production of new cells to build organs and tissues is called mitosis, from mitos, the Greek word for thread. In contrast, the birth of new cells, sperm, and eggs for the purpose of reproduction to make a new organism is called meiosis from meion, the Greek word for lessening. The German scientist who discovered mitosis was a disillusioned, short-sighted military doctor seeking a new vision for biology. Walter Fleming, the son of a psychiatrist trained in medicine in the 1860s. Like Rudolf Virchow, he also attended a military medical school, and like Virchow again, he found the discipline regimented and inflexible and soon turned to studying cells. Humans, all multicellular creatures, were made of cells. And yet the building of an organism out of cells, from one cell to several billion, was a mysterious process. In the 1870s, Fleming became particularly intrigued by cellular anatomy, and he began to use aniline dyes and their derivatives to stain tissues, hoping to illuminate subcellular structures. At first, Fleming saw very little. The dye revealed only a wispy, thread-like substance located almost exclusively within the nucleus. The typically spherical, membrane-bound structure within the cell first discovered by the Scottish botanist Robert Brown in the 1830s. Fleming, following his colleague Wilhelm von Waldeyer Hartz, christened the nucleus-dwelling, thread-like substances, chromosomes, colored bodies, a neutral name. He wondered about their function and their dynamics during cell division. His curiosity aroused, Fleming kept looking at dividing cells under the scope. Looking but not seeing. Sight, real sight, requires insight. Other scientists, such as von Moll and Riemach, had observed cells divide but concluded very little about the orchestration or phases of the process. Fleming realized that they had been looking at cells, not inside cells. His critical insight appeared in 1878. It involved staining chromosomes with blue dye during cell division, and then following the whole process of division under the microscope, thereby capturing the activity of chromosomes and the nucleus within the cell. What did chromosomes do, and how was the nucleus or the chromosomes inside it related to cell division? What forces act during cell division, he asked, in a two-part paper written in 1878 and 1880. Do the shifts in the positions of the visible formed structures in the cell, the nucleus and the chromosomes during cell division, follow a scheme? And if so, what scheme? Theodore Boveri and Walter Sutton would make the next logical link, connecting chromosomes to inheritance. In short, they would link genetic inheritance to the anatomical physical inheritance of chromosomes, thereby situating genes and inheritance on chromosomes. In his experiments with peas, Gregor Mendel could identify genes only in the abstract as factors that would move across generations and carry traits or features from parents to their offspring. He had no means to identify the physical location of these factors. Sutton and Boveri, among others, would provide the first evidence that the inheritance of characteristics, that is, genes, occurs through the inheritance of chromosomes. Work by the fruit fly geneticist Thomas Morgan and others would build on this theory, finally placing the locus of genes on chromosomes. Decades later, studies by Frederick Griffith, Oswald Avery, James Watson, Francis Crick, and Rosalind Franklin, among others, would identify DNA, the molecule that lies at the center of the chromosome, as the carrier of genetic information. And further research by Marshall Nirenberg and colleagues at the National Institutes of Health, NIH, would identify how genes are decoded to create proteins that ultimately provide forms and features to organisms. The scheme Fleming found was startlingly systematic. It was staged as precisely as a military drill. In the larvae of salamanders, in the dividing cells of mammals, amphibians, and fish, Fleming found a common rhythm of cell division that ran through virtually every organism. It was an exhilarating result. No scientist before him had even faintly imagined that the cells of such diverse organisms would follow a nearly identical and rhythmic scheme during the division of their cells. The botanist Carl Wilhelm von Nageli regarded Fleming's experiments as an anomaly, but then he also dismissed Mendel's paper as the work of a crank. It was only decades later that the universal principles of cell division were elucidated in all organisms. The first step, Fleming found, was the condensation of the thread-like chromosomes into thickened bundles. Skeins, he called them. The dye now bound strongly. The chromosomes glowed under the scope like reels of thread dyed with deep indigo. Then the condensed chromosomes doubled and split along a defined axis, creating structures that reminded him of two starbursts splitting. The nuclear figures began to organize themselves into successive stages during division, he wrote. The nuclear membrane dissolved, and the nucleus, too, began to split. At last, the cell itself divided, its membrane segmented, giving rise to two daughter cells. Once in the daughter cells, the chromosomes uncondensed slowly and returned to their wispy resting stage, back in the nuclei of the daughter cells, as if reversing the process that had initiated cell division. Since the chromosomes doubled at first and then halved upon cell division, the number of chromosomes in the daughter cells was conserved. 46 became 92 and was halved to 46. Fleming called it homotypic, or conservative, cell division. The parent cell and the daughter cells ended up with the same conserved number of chromosomes. Two other cytologists, Edward Strasburger and Edward von Beneden, also observed the separation of chromosomes, followed by the division of the cell membrane into two daughter cells, mitosis. Between the 1880s and the early 1900s, the biologists Theodore Boveri, Oscar Hertwig, and Edmund Wilson would contribute a great many details to this initial sketch of cell division, delving further into each of the individual steps that Fleming had initially described. Fleming drew the process as a cycle. The thread-like chromosomes condensed into skeins, split, and then returned to a resting state. And then they compacted and dilated again as the cell edged toward its next division cycle, condensing, splitting, and decondensing, almost as if a breath of life was moving through them. His drawings are included in the attached PDF. But there had to be a different kind of cell division, the kind that leads to reproduction. It is easy, in retrospect, to understand that the dynamics of this form of cell division could not possibly be the same as that of mitosis. It's a matter of elementary mathematics. In mitosis, you'll recall, the parent cell and the daughter cells end up with the same number of chromosomes. You start, say, with 46, the number of chromosomes in human cells. The chromosomes duplicate, 92, and then each daughter cell gets half, back to 46. But how might those numbers work for reproduction? If sperm and eggs had the same number of chromosomes as their parent cells, 46, then the fertilized egg would contain twice the number, 92. That number would double in the next generation to 184, and then double again to 368, and so forth, increasing exponentially generation upon generation. Soon the cell would explode with chromosomes. The genesis of sperm and eggs, then, must require first halving the number of chromosomes, 23 each, and then restoring them back to 46 upon fertilization. This variant of cell division, reduction, followed by restoration, was observed in sea urchins by Theodore Boveri and Oscar Hertwig in the mid-1870s. In 1883, Belgian zoologist Edward van Beneden also observed meiosis in worms, confirming the commonality of the process in more complex organisms. The life cycle for a multicellular organism, in short, could be reconceived as a rather simple back-and-forth game between meiosis and mitosis. Humans, starting with 46 chromosomes in every bodily cell, produce sperm cells in the testes and egg cells in the ovaries via meiosis, each ending up with 23 chromosomes. When sperm and egg meet to form a zygote, the number of chromosomes is restored to 46. The zygote grows through cell division, mitosis, to produce the embryo, and then develops progressively mature tissues and organs, heart, lungs, blood, kidneys, brain, with cells that have 46 chromosomes each. As the organism matures, it eventually develops a gonad, testes or ovaries, with 46 chromosomes in each cell. And here, the game shifts again. When the cells in the gonads make male and female reproductive cells, they undergo meiosis, generating sperm and eggs with 23 chromosomes each. Fertilization restores the number to 46. A zygote is born, and the cycle repeats. Meiosis, mitosis, meiosis. Have, restore, grow. Have, restore, grow, ad infinitum. What controls the division of a cell? Fleming had witnessed the systematic stages of mitosis, but who, or rather what, conducts this staging? In the decades after Fleming published his seminal work on cell division, cell biologists noted that the life cycle of a dividing cell could be divided into phases. Let us begin with cells that opt out of the cycle altogether. They are permanently or semi-permanently resting, quiescent, to use biology jargon. The phase is now termed G0, the G0 referring to the gap or resting cycle. In fact, some of these cells will never divide. They are post-mitotic. Most mature neurons are good examples. When a cell makes a decision to enter the cycle of division, it moves into a new gap period, termed G1. It is almost as if it's dipping its toe into the waters of cell division, contemplating its decision. Few changes are visible under a microscope during G1, but in molecular terms, this first gap is monumental. The proteins that coordinate cell division are synthesized. Mitochondria are duplicated. The cell gathers molecules, summoning and synthesizing those that are crucial to metabolism and sustenance, and increasing them in number before they will be apportioned to the two daughter cells. It is also the first critical checkpoint in a cell's decision whether or not to commit to the enormity of cell division. Go or not go? If certain nutrients are absent, or if the hormonal milieu is not appropriate, the cell might choose to remain in G1. It is a point before the point of no return. The phase that follows gap 1 is distinct and unique. The duplication of chromosomes, and therefore the synthesis of new DNA. It demands energy, commitment, and a drastic shift in focus. It is termed the S phase from synthesis of duplicate chromosomes. If you inhabited the interior of the cell, swimming, as you once were, in the protoplasm, you might sense a shift in its hub of activity away from the cytoplasm and toward the nucleus. Enzymes that duplicate DNA latch onto chromosomes. Yet other enzymes begin to unwind DNA. The building blocks of DNA are shuttled to the nucleus. A complex assemblage of DNA replicating enzymes strings along the chromosomes, synthesizing a duplicate copy, and an apparatus to pull the duplicated chromosomes apart begins to form within the cell. The third phase is perhaps the most mysterious and least understood. A second resting phase called G2. Why stop a cell from dividing once it has synthesized a duplicate chromosome? Why waste a freshly synthesized strand of DNA? G2 exists as a final checkpoint before cell division because cells cannot afford chromosomal catastrophes such as translocations, broken arms of DNA, drastic mutations, deletions. This is a time when the cell checks and double-checks the fidelity of DNA replication, guarding against damage to DNA or a devastating event in a chromosome. A cell showered with DNA-damaging radiation or chemotherapy might halt at this stage. Proteins termed the guardians of the genome, among them the P53 tumor suppressor, scan the genome in the cell to ensure its health before generating new cells. As checkpoints go, G2 seems like a perfectly simple solution until you realize that it has to perform a rather delicate balancing act. G2 arrest, as far as we know, is reserved largely for detecting catastrophic mutations in a cell. Mutations are generated in the S phase. Like any copying machine with an intrinsic error rate, the molecular machines that produce new copies of DNA during the synthesis phase make mistakes. Some of these are instantly repaired, but some remain. If G2 were to arrest every mutation, catch every mistake, and rectify every error, mutants would never be generated and evolution would come to a grinding halt. G2, then, must be a discerning guardian, knowing when to look and when to look away. The final phase is M, mitosis itself, the splitting of the cell into two daughter cells. The nuclear membrane dissolves, the about-to-separate chromosomes tighten even farther into the dense structures that Fleming had stained with his dyes. The molecular apparatus to pull apart duplicated chromosomes is fully assembled. And now the duplicated chromosomes lying side by side, like twins in a cot, begin to get tugged away from one another until half occupy one side of the cell, while the other half is pulled to the opposite side. A furrow appears between the cells, and the cytoplasm of the cell is halved. The mother cell generates two daughter cells. I met Paul Nurse in 2017 on a car ride across the plains of the Netherlands. He was a compact man with an English accent and a broad, open smile who reminded me of an elderly, wizened version of Bilbo Baggins. We were both giving talks at the Wilhelmina Children's Hospital in Utrecht, so we shared a car from Amsterdam to the campus. Nurse was friendly, humble, and kind, the sort of scientist I took an instant liking to. The landscape around us was flat and homogeneous, dry, tilled fields of hay and straw, punctuated with a few windmills that moved cyclically with the occasional gusts of wind. Cycles, the mechanics of energy, the rise and fall of the wind that drove the cycles of a machine. Was the dividing cell such a machine cycling through division and rest? When Nurse was a postdoc in Edinburgh, he began to wonder about the coordination of a cell cycle. Which factors govern whether or when a cell decides to divide? In the 1870s and 1880s, Fleming and Boveri, among others, had observed the distinct stages of cell division. The question was, which molecules and signals conducted and regulated these phases? How did a cell know when to move from, say, the G1 phase to S phase? Nurse came from a working-class family. My dad was a blue-collar worker, he told a journalist in 2014. My mom was a cleaner. My siblings all left school at 15. I was different. I passed exams, and I somehow got into university, got a scholarship, and did a PhD. Decades after his university days, Nurse would learn that his sister was actually his mother. Born out of an unmarried liaison, Nurse was raised by his grandmother, who acted as his mother until the secret arrangement was finally revealed to him many years later when he was in his 60s. He told me the story matter-of-factly as we neared Utrecht. His eyes twinkled. Reproduction is never as simple as it seems, he added dryly. Nurse's mentor at the University of Edinburgh, Murdoch Mitchison, had been studying the cell cycle in a particular strain of yeast called fission yeast. Fission because they reproduce much like human cells by splitting in the middle. The more common yeast cells divide by budding, a process in which a smaller nub of a daughter cell appears as the cell divides. In the 1980s, Nurse began to make mutants of yeast that would not divide properly. Nearly 5,000 miles away in Seattle, the cell biologist Lee Hartwell had also arrived at a similar strategy. He was also going to hunt for genes that affected the cell cycle and cell division by producing mutants in a different strain, Baker's yeast, the budding variety. Both Hartwell and Nurse hoped that the mutants would lead them to discover the normal genes that control cell division. It was an old biological trick, disrupting a physiological function in order to illuminate normal physiology. An anatomist might cut or ligate an artery in an animal and then track the body part that was no longer perfused and thereby learn the artery's function. Or a geneticist might mutate a gene to disrupt a genetic process, cell division, for example, and thereby uncover the functional master regulators that govern the process of mitosis. In the summer of 1982, Tim Hunt, a cell biologist from Cambridge University, traveled to the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, on scenic Cape Cod, to help teach a course on embryology. Tourists in whale-printed shorts and linen shirts came to the Cape to eat fried clams and lounge on its expansive sand beaches. Scientists, in turn, came there to scour the shallow, rocky tide pools for clams and, more often, for sea urchins. Urchin eggs, in particular, offered a precious resource, for they were large and easy experimental models. Inject a female urchin with a simple salt solution, and she will burst forth with an efflorescence of dozens of orange eggs. Fertilize the eggs with male urchin sperm, and the zygote will develop and begin dividing with clock-like regularity to start forming a new multicellular animal. From Fleming in the 1870s to Hunt in the 1980s, scientists had used these spiny, globular creatures with their erotic tongues of flesh, whoever thought of eating them, as model systems to study fertilization, cell division, and embryology. What the fruit fly had been to early genetics, the urchin would be to the study of the cell cycle. Hunt wanted to study how the synthesis of proteins was controlled after fertilization, but it was frustrating, halting work. By 1982, he wrote, work on the control of protein synthesis in sea urchin eggs had almost ground to a halt. Every idea that my students and I tested proved to be false, and the very basis of the system was essentially flawed. But as dusk fell on the evening of July 22, 1982, Hunt noted a remarkable phenomenon. Exactly 10 minutes before a fertilized urchin cell divided, one abundant protein would peak in concentration, then disappear. It was rhythmic and regular, the precise churn of a windmill's vane. At the evening seminar followed by the wine and cheese hour that night, he learned that other scientists, including Mark Kirshner at Harvard, had also been puzzling over how cells transitioned from one phase to the next during the genesis of sperm and eggs, or meiosis. The idea that the rise and ebb of a protein could signal the transition from one phase to the next mesmerized Hunt. He may have hardly finished his glass of wine before he was back in the lab. Over the next decade, Hunt returned to the Cape year after year with a lab and a suitcase, tubes and tips and gel plates and even a peristaltic pump, to try to decipher the mechanisms that enabled transitions in the cell cycle. By the winter of 1986, Hunt and his students had found more such proteins that increased and decreased precisely in conjunction with phases of mitotic cell division. One might peak and drop in perfect step with the S phase, the stage at which chromosomes are duplicated. Another might rise and fall with the G2 phase, the second checkpoint before cell division occurs. Hunt called these proteins cyclins because he was a cycling enthusiast. He would soon realize that he had given them a befitting name. These proteins seemed to be preternaturally coordinated with phases of the cycles of cell division. The name stuck. Nurse and Hartwell, meanwhile, were also closing in on the cell cycle controlling genes using their mutant-hunting approach in yeast cells. They, too, had found several genes associated with different phases of cell division. In the late 1980s, they named these CDC and later CDK genes. The proteins encoded by them were called CDK proteins. These were initially called CDC genes for cell division cycle, but the terminology was changed to CDC-CDK and then to CDK. The K refers to an enzymatic activity of the proteins encoded by these genes, a kinase that adds a phosphate group to its target protein and typically activates it. For simplification, I will say CDK gene for the gene and CDK protein for the protein. The same applies to the cyclin family. The proteins will be called cyclin proteins. But there was an unsettling mystery in the separate lines of discovery. Despite the obvious convergences in their questions, they had not found the same proteins, with one notable exception. One of Nurse's mutants was, indeed, in a cyclin-like gene. Why? Why was Hunt finding cyclin proteins in his hunt for regulators of the cell cycle? And why were Hartwell and Nurse finding a mostly different set of proteins that coordinated the division of cells? It was as if two sets of mathematicians, having solved the same equation, had emerged with two different answers, and yet, at least in method, both seemed right. What, in short, had the cyclin proteins to do with the CDK proteins? In the 1980s and 1990s, working with teams of researchers, Hunt, Hartwell, and Nurse discovered a synthesis of all the observations. In essence, reconciling the role of the cyclin proteins and the CDK proteins in the cell cycle. The proteins act in concert to regulate the transitions in the phases of cell division. They are partners and collaborators, functionally, genetically, biochemically, physically linked. They are the yin and yang of cell division. A particular cyclin protein, we now know, binds to a particular CDK protein and activates it. That activation, in turn, unleashes a cascade of molecular events in the cell, pinging from one activated molecule to another, like a pinball, that ultimately commands the cell to transition from one phase of the cell cycle to the next. Hunt had solved half the puzzle. Nurse and Hartwell had solved the other half. To see this in diagram form, please see the attached PDF. As Nurse told me on the ride to Utrecht, we were just looking at the same thing from two different sides. If you step back, it was really the same thing. It was as if we had caught two different shadows of the same object. The mills whirled around us, completing yet another cycle. Cyclin proteins and CDK proteins work together, but different pairs signal the different transitions. One particular cyclin-CDK association might act as the master regulator of the transition from G2 to M. The cyclin activates the CDK protein, which then activates more proteins to facilitate the transition. When the cyclin protein is degraded, the activity of the CDK protein ceases, and the cell awaits the next signal for its next phase. Another cyclin-CDK protein combination regulates the transition from G1 to S. Dozens of other proteins join the coordination of cell division, but intimate association between a cyclin protein and its cognate CDK protein is integral. They are partners in cell cycle control, the central conductors of the orchestra that Fleming had observed nearly a century before. It is hard to point to an arena of medicine or biology that wasn't changed by our understanding of the cell cycle or the dynamics of how cells divide. What makes cancer cells divide? And can we find medicines to specifically block this malignant division? How does a blood stem cell divide to produce a copy of itself, termed self-renewal, under certain circumstances, versus producing mature blood cells, differentiation, under other circumstances? How does an embryo grow out of a single cell? In 2001, in recognition of the universal importance of their work elucidating the mechanism by which cells control their division, Hartwell, Hunt, and Nurse shared the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine. It is intriguing, given the central role of cyclin proteins and CDK proteins in cell division, that few cancer therapies that can block cyclins or CDKs have emerged or been successful. For the most part, this is because cell division is a universal phenomenon essential for life, and it represents far too degenerate a target for cancer therapy. Kill a dividing cancer cell, and you'd also kill a dividing normal cell, thereby unleashing intolerable toxicities. In the late 1990s, a family of drugs was found to inhibit CDK4/6, two particular members of the CDK protein family. Almost two decades later, trials proved that new generations of these drugs, in low doses and in combination with other medicines, such as Herceptin, an antibody drug against breast cancer, would extend survival in certain patients with breast cancer. The search for cancer-specific cyclin proteins and CDK protein inhibitors continues, although the specter of toxicity inevitably hangs over such drugs. Perhaps no arena of medicine is conceptually closer to cell division, to mitosis and meiosis, than artificial or medically assisted human reproduction, or in vitro fertilization, IVF. The word artificial seems odd here. Isn't all of medicine artificial? Should we call the use of antibiotics to treat a pneumonia artificial immunity? Or the delivery of a baby, the artificial externalization of a fetus? So I'll use medically assisted reproduction, even though artificial reproduction is the more commonplace term. By medically assisted reproduction, I am speaking of the body of medicine that seeks to enhance human reproduction using drugs, hormones, surgical intervention, and ex vivo, outside the body, manipulation of human cells. The range of the discipline is broad. It might involve enhancing the production of human sperm and eggs and enabling their extraction and storage. It might include methods to fertilize sperm and eggs outside the body, or cultivating living human embryos and then implanting them into a female womb to produce a baby. To this list, we might add new technologies that are rapidly intersecting with reproductive strategies. The genetic engineering of human sperm, eggs, and embryos to produce new kinds of cells and, by extension, new kinds of humans. Let us begin with a fact that is both strikingly self-evident to a cell therapist and startling to someone outside the field. In vitro fertilization, IVF, is cell therapy. It is, in fact, among the most common cell therapies in human use. It has been a reproductive option for more than four decades and has produced roughly 8 to 10 million children. Many of those IVF babies are now adults with children of their own, typically produced without any need for in vitro fertilization. It has become so familiar, indeed, that we don't even imagine it as cellular medicine, although, of course, it is precisely that. The therapeutic manipulation of human cells to ameliorate an ancient and aching form of human suffering, infertility. The technology had an unsteady birth. In fact, it nearly died of prematurity. The scientific animosity, personal rivalry, the public dissent, and even the medical dissent that accompanied the birth of IVF has largely been airbrushed by its success. But the inception of the technology was nothing but intensely turbulent and controversial. In the mid-1950s, an unorthodox, secretive professor who taught obstetrics and gynecology at Columbia University, Landrum Shettles, launched a project to create an in vitro fertilized human baby. He wanted to cure infertility. Shettles, who had seven children, rarely went home to rest. His lab was furnished with a large, overgrown fish tank and a series of clocks. He slept on a makeshift cot amid the constant tick-tocking, and the medical residents would often find him in his wrinkled green scrubs wandering the halls late at night. At first, Shettles performed his experiments in petri dishes and test tubes. He harvested human eggs from a female donor, then fertilized them with human sperm and managed to keep the primordial embryo alive for 6 days. He published frequently and won awards for his work, including the Markle Prize from Columbia. But then, his career took an odd turn. In 1973, Shettles agreed to help a Florida couple, Dr. John DelZio and Doris DelZio, conceive a child. Shettles did not report the extension of the work, from fertilization in petri dishes to the implantation of an embryo to the hospital's regulatory or experimental committees. Nor did he inform the chief of obstetrics. On September 12, 1973, a gynecologist at New York University Hospital, harvested eggs from Doris. John carried the eggs in a vial of his semen in a taxi uptown to Shettle's lab. The trip, which I imagine would have taken about an hour through uptown traffic, may have ranked as among the tensest cab rides in New York history. Dr. Shettle's supervisor, in the meantime, had learned of the experiment, and he was livid. The creation of a human embryo in vitro, a test tube baby, for implantation into a real womb was unheard of, and the medical and ethical implications were obviously uncharted. The story, perhaps apocryphal, is that the supervisor barged into the lab, threw open the incubators with the fertilized eggs, and destroyed the experiment. The Delzios sued the hospital and won $50,000 for emotional damage. Unsurprisingly, Shettles, fish tanks, sleeping cot, clocks, green scrubs at midnight, was fired by his department and thrown out of the university soon after. He moved to a Vermont clinic, where his unorthodox manners got him into trouble again, and finally settled into his own clinic in Las Vegas, where he promised to continue his dreams of making human babies using IVF. In England, meanwhile, a duo of scientists, Robert Edwards and Patrick Steptoe, were also attempting in vitro fertilization. Unlike Shettles, they were not tone-deaf to the scientific and moral crossings required to produce a human embryo in a glass jar. They dutifully wrote protocols and papers, presented their work at conferences, and informed hospital committees and departments of their intentions. They worked slowly and methodically, overturning orthodoxy upon orthodoxy. Mavericks they were, but, in the words of science historian Margaret Marsh, careful mavericks. Edwards, the son of a railroad worker father and a milling machinist mother, was a geneticist and physiologist interested in cell division and chromosomal abnormalities. His career was derailed temporarily by 4 years in the British Army during World War II, as well as by the time spent earning an undergraduate degree in zoology, which he described as a disaster. My grants were spent, and I was in debt. Unlike some of the students, I had no rich parents. I could not write home, "Dear Dad, please send me £100, as I did badly in the exams." But Edwards eventually found a spot studying animal genetics at the University of Edinburgh, where his interest began to swerve towards studying reproduction. He undertook experiments with mouse sperm and then switched to eggs. Collaborating with his wife, Ruth Fowler, an accomplished zoologist, Edwards demonstrated that injecting mice with ovulation-inducing hormones could generate dozens of eggs that were at a similar stage of their life cycles and could, therefore, in principle, be harvested and fertilized in vitro in a dish. In 1963, after a wayfaring career through various universities, Edwards came to Cambridge University to study the maturation of human egg cells. He, Ruth, and their five daughters settled into a modest house on Gough Way, off the Barton Road, and into a lab atop the physiological laboratory that was a warren of seven poorly heated rooms. The field of reproductive biology, and especially the connection between egg and sperm maturation and the cell cycle, was in its infancy. Tim Hunt's work on sea urchins, which would lay the foundation for the cell cycle, was decades away from being published, and the cell division genes that would make Paul Nurse and Lee Hartwell famous were yet undiscovered. Edwards knew of the work of Harvard scientists John Rock and Miriam Menken, who, in the mid-1940s, had extracted nearly 800 eggs from women undergoing gynecological surgery and tried to fertilize these with human sperm. Success was hit and miss. "We have made numerous attempts to initiate in vitro fertilization of human ovarian eggs," Menken wrote in a journal article. But the project turned out to be more complicated than either Rock or Menken had expected. More often than not, the eggs could not be fertilized. In 1951, Min Chua Chang, a little-recognized scientist working on reproduction at the Worcester Institute in Massachusetts, realized that the sperm, and not only the egg, might contribute equally to the problem to achieve IVF. Working with rabbits, he proposed that a sperm cell had to be activated, capacitated, he called it, before it could fertilize an egg. This capacitation, Chang reasoned, was achieved by exposing the sperm to particular conditions and chemicals in the female fallopian tubes. Edward sat in the hushed, reverential silence of the library of the National Institute of Medical Research in Mill Hill, London, for months on end, intensely scrutinizing all these prior experiments. It was like studying a litany of failure, but he wanted to try fertilizing human eggs outside the body again. Initially, he worked with a gynecologist, Molly Rose, at Edgware General Hospital to ripen the eggs, in essence, to make them receptive to fertilization. But unlike rabbit and mouse eggs, human eggs wouldn't ripen. 3, 6, 9, and 12 hours, none of them changed their appearance in any way whatsoever. "They gazed back at me," he wrote. "The eggs seemed, well, impenetrable." And then, one morning in 1963, Edwards had a crucial insight, as simple as it was profound. What if, he wondered, the ripening program in the eggs of primates such as humans might simply take longer than in rodents? Again, Edwards obtained a small bushel of eggs from Rose and ripened them, but this time he chose to wait. "I must not look at them too early," he wrote, reprimanding himself for his impatience. After 18 hours exactly, I looked and saw, alas, the nucleus unchanged. No sign of ripening at all. Failure again. Now he had just 2 eggs left, staring at him obdurately, unfazed in the dish. At 24 hours, Edwards pulled one out and thought he saw the barest hint of ripening. Something was changing in the nucleus. 1 egg left. At 28 hours, he pulled out the last egg and stained it. "Excitement beyond belief," he wrote. "The chromosomes were just beginning their march through the center of the egg. The cell had ripened. It was ready for fertilization. There, in 1 egg in the last of the group, lay the whole secret of the human program. The moral? We don't reproduce like rabbits. Our eggs need a little more seduction." Edwards was nearing the end of his lonely decade, but there was yet another circular quandary that he had to countenance. The eggs that Rose had supplied were from women undergoing extensive gynecological surgery and therefore highly unlikely to undergo in vitro fertilization. And so, while most convenient as experimental material, the eggs that came from Rose's surgeries were the least amenable for reimplantation. To finish his experiment, Edwards needed human eggs from another source. The eggs came from patients of Dr. Patrick Steptoe, women with ovarian conditions who had agreed to donate eggs. Steptoe was a consultant obstetrician at the General Hospital in Oldham, a declining, fog-blurred textile manufacturing town near Manchester. His particular interest was ovarian laparoscopy, a procedure that entails operating on the ovary and its surrounding tissues using a flexible scope inserted through small incisions in the lower abdomen. The minimally invasive technique was often derided by gynecologists because they imagined it as imprecise compared with invasive open surgery. At one medical conference, a distinguished gynecologist stood up and announced imperiously, "Laparoscopy is of no use whatsoever. It's impossible to visualize the ovary." Steptoe, soft-spoken and reticent, had to rise up to defend his practice. "You are hopelessly wrong," he replied. "The whole abdominal cavity can be inspected." Robert Edwards happened to be in attendance. While gynecologists dismissed Steptoe, Edwards' ears pricked up, for laparoscopic extraction, he realized, was crucial to his success. Unlike the eggs that he had obtained from invasive surgical procedures, laparoscopic extraction would make the procedure vastly more tractable for women, and perhaps precisely for a woman who might want a fertilized egg reimplanted in her womb. At the end of the presentations, while the audience bickered and quarreled, Edwards ambled up to Steptoe in the foyer. "You are Patrick Steptoe?" he said gently. "Yes. I am Bob Edwards." They exchanged notes and ideas on in vitro fertilization. On April 1, 1968, Edwards traveled to Oldham to meet with Steptoe. They drew up an experimental plan, and Steptoe agreed to send Edwards some human eggs harvested through his laparoscopic operations. That Oldham was a full 5 hours away from Cambridge did not deter either of them. The round trip to bring an egg from Steptoe's clinic to Edward's lab might involve the better part of a day on a train trundling slowly through smoky, rain-drenched Lancashire county towns. The experimental protocol seemed simple, but the details were complicated. Which culture solution would keep the egg and sperm alive? How many hours after egg harvest should the sperm be introduced? How many cell divisions were necessary before a fertilized egg might become viable in a human body? And how might one know which embryo to pick? From Dr. Barry Bavister, a colleague at Cambridge, Edwards learned that the rate of fertilization increased vastly if you increased the alkalinity of the solution. This was part of the sperm capacitation that had stymied Min Chua Chang. Edwards picked up additional tricks to activate sperm, and he learned to ripen eggs in culture, waiting for the exact moment of ripening before adding the sperm to it. There were ratios to be determined, how many sperm per egg, and the exact composition of the fluid for culturing embryos. But piece by piece, Edwards and Steptoe solved the problem of in vitro fertilization. One afternoon late in the winter of 1968, Jean Purdy, a scientist and nurse working with Edwards, set up the crucial experiment. "Those eggs," she wrote, "were soon ripening in mixtures of culture medium, to which some of Barry Bavister's fluid had been added. 36 hours later, we judged that they were ready for fertilization." That evening, Bavister and Edwards drove to the hospital and studied the culture under the microscope. An awe-inspiring event was unfolding under the lens. The first steps in the conception of human life. According to Purdy, a spermatozoan was just passing into the first egg. An hour later, we looked at the second egg. Yes, there it was, the earliest stages of fertilization. A spermatozoan had entered the egg without any doubt. We had done it. We examined other eggs and found more and more evidence. Some ova were in the early stages of fertilization, with the sperm tails following the sperm heads into the depths of the egg. Others were even more advanced, with two nuclei, one from the sperm and one from the egg, as each sperm and egg cell donated its genetic component to the embryo. They had achieved in vitro fertilization. The paper by Edwards, Steptoe, and Bavister, Early Stages of Fertilization in Vitro of Human Oocytes Matured in Vitro, was published in the journal Nature in 1969. Unfortunately, Jean Purdy, who had performed the experiment, was not credited, consistent with the conventional practice of cutting women out of science. Later, both Edwards and Steptoe made several attempts to acknowledge her contributions, for IVF was born in Purdy's hands. In the lab, she created the first human embryo produced through IVF. In the hospital, she would later cradle the first IVF baby. In 1985, she died of melanoma at just 39 years of age, never able to fully garner the scientific recognition due to her. The study set off a public, scientific, and medical furor almost immediately. Attacks came from all sides at once. Some gynecologists did not consider infertility a disease. Reproduction, they argued, was not a requirement for wellness, so why define its absence as an illness? As one historian wrote, "It is perhaps difficult now to comprehend the complete absence of infertility from the consciousness of most gynecologists in the UK at the time, of whom Steptoe was a remarkable exception." Overpopulation and family planning were seen as dominant concerns, and the infertile were ignored as, at best, a tiny and irrelevant minority and, at worst, as a positive contribution to population control. Much of the gynecological research in the United Kingdom and the United States focused on contraception, that is, bringing fewer babies into the world. In America, one scientific paper noted, "Contraceptive development research increased over sixfold between 1965 and 1969, and private philanthropic funding went up 30 times. Religious groups, in turn, pointed to the special status of the human embryo. To produce one in a laboratory petri dish intended for transfer into a human body was to violate the most inviolable laws of natural human reproduction. And ethicists were hyperconscious of the legacy of Nazi experiments from the 1940s, in which humans were subjected to horrific risks but with little benefit. What if the babies produced by this method, or the mothers who would carry these babies, turned out to bear unknown risks? It took almost a decade after the publication of Early Stages of Fertilization to convince the medical community that infertility was, in fact, a disease. Working with teams of obstetricians and laboratory technicians in the mid-70s, they launched their first efforts to make a living baby via IVF. On November 10, 1977, a tiny cluster of living embryonic cells, about 25 times smaller than a grain of rice, was transferred into the womb of Leslie Brown. The 30-year-old British woman and her husband John had been trying to conceive naturally for 9 years, but failed after many attempts. Leslie's fallopian tubes were blocked, and her eggs, albeit functionally normal, were anatomically obstructed in their movement from her ovary to the site of fertilization in the tubes or in the uterus. During the procedure, carried out at Oldham General, her eggs were harvested directly from the ovary, ripened using Edwards and Purdy's protocol, and then fertilized with John's sperm. Purdy was the first to see the embryonic cells begin their division with tiny jerks of movement, a cellular quickening, as it were, captured in a glass jar. About 9 months later, on July 25, 1978, the hospital's operation theater was packed with researchers, doctors, and a team of government administrators. It was close to midnight when Dr. John Webster, an obstetrician, delivered a baby girl by cesarean section. The operation was completed under a veil of absolute secrecy. Steptoe had originally announced that the birth would occur the next morning, but quietly changed it to midnight the night before, in part to outwit journalists who were thronging outside the hospital. Earlier that evening, he had driven off from the hospital in his white Mercedes in an elaborately planned smokescreen to convince the journalists that the team was packing up for the night. He had crept back surreptitiously at nightfall. The delivery was spectacularly unremarkable. The baby didn't have to be resuscitated at all, and the pediatrician who examined her for any defects didn't find any, Webster recalled. We'd all been a little concerned that if by chance she had been born with a cleft palate or another minor defect that we couldn't pick up beforehand, that would have effectively killed off the research because people would have said that it was due to the technique of IVF. Every fingernail, every eyelash, every toe, every joint, every inch of skin was examined. The baby was angelically perfect. There were no wild celebrations, said Webster. After the delivery, the obstetrician went to bed to a quiet night of sleep. I felt quite whacked, really, he recalled. I simply went back to the house where I was staying and had some supper. I don't think there was even any booze in the cupboard. The baby was christened Louise Brown. Her middle name is Joy. The following morning, news of Brown's birth exploded in the press. Over the next week, the hospital was barraged by journalists with flashing cameras and notebooks in hand, straining to get a picture of the mother and her daughter. Louise Brown was called a test tube baby, an odd term since test tubes were hardly used during the fertilization. The large glass jar in which she was actually conceived is displayed at the Science Museum in London. Her birth provoked a tsunami of fury, celebration, relief, and pride. In an indignant letter to Time magazine, a woman from Michigan fumed, "The Browns have degraded and institutionalized the child, and for that act, not for their act of medically assisted birth, the Browns should be viewed as symbols of the degeneration of Western morals." An anonymous package from America arrived at the Browns' home in Bristol, containing a broken test tube splashed with a grotesque spray of fake blood. Others, however, called her a miracle baby. The July 31st cover of Time borrowed the famous detail from the Creation of Adam, the Michelangelo painting that adorns the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, in which God's finger is poised to touch Adam's. Except here, suspended between the two fingers is a test tube, and in it, a graphic of an embryo, Louise Brown in utero. For men and women who'd been unable to have children, this breakthrough brought extraordinary hope. Infertility had been cured, at least for those who still had viable sperm and eggs. Louise Joy Brown is now 43 years old. She has her mother's soft, rounded features, her father's open smile, and blonde brown hair, once a torrent of curls, now straightened and golden. She works for a freight company and lives near Bristol. When she was 4, she was told that she had been born in a slightly different way than everybody else. That sentence may be one of the pivotal understatements in the history of science. Robert Edwards received the Nobel Prize in 2010 for his work. Unfortunately, he died before he could attend the ceremony that December. Steptoe, who was 12 years older than Edwards, had died in 1988, and Landrum Shettles passed away in Las Vegas in 2003, insisting, till the end, that he would have been the first to develop IVF had his efforts not been scuttled by the orthodoxies of his superiors. This audiobook is about the cell and the transformation of medicine. And while in vitro fertilization may rank among the most commonly used cell therapies in medicine, there is a peculiarity in its history that must be confronted. It was the perfect storm of advances in reproductive biology and obstetrics, not cell biology, that brought the procedure to life. While the birth of Louise Brown signaled the rebirth of reproductive medicine, the procedural aspects of IVF maintained a rather frigid indifference to the rapidly moving fronts of cell biology. Even Edwards, whose initial interest in reproduction had been sparked by abnormal chromosomal division during egg maturation, a 1962 scientific paper of his was titled Meiosis and Ovarian Oocytes of Adult Mammals, wrote virtually nothing further about the discoveries of cell cycle, chromosome segregation, and the molecular control of meiosis and mitosis once those insights had arrived from Nurse, Hartwell, and Hunt in the 1980s. Stranger still was the fact that Hunt was his colleague at Cambridge while Nurse worked less than 50 miles away. And the aspects of cellular physiology that you might expect fertilization and embryo maturation to have the most naturally affinity with, the dynamics of cell division, the production of sperm and eggs, the mitotic stages of the zygote, remained in the distant periphery of the field's vision. IVF, in short, was perceived primarily as a hormonal intervention followed by an obstetric procedure. Eggs and sperm were extracted and went in. A human baby came out. The lab in between, where fertilization occurred and the embryo matured, was merely a link in the chain. The incubator was quite literally a black box, albeit a moist, warm one. And how an egg or sperm could be made more fecund, or how the best embryos might be selected for implantation, both questions that intimately invoke cell biology and chromosomal and cellular assessment, remained open and unanswered. But the insights of Nurse, Hartwell, and Hunt are, at last, beginning to enter the field and transform it. It is now increasingly evident that questions that have furrowed through human reproduction can be answered only by understanding cellular reproduction, again bringing to mind Rudolf Virchow's tenet that all disease is cellular disease. IVF is thus learning the vocabulary of cyclins and CDK proteins. Why, for instance, is it sometimes tough to harvest eggs from some women despite hormonal stimulation? In 2016, a group of researchers demonstrated that the very molecules that Nurse, Hartwell, and Hunt had discovered, cyclins and CDK proteins, are involved. As long as one such combination, CDK1 protein and a cyclin protein, remains inactive in egg cells, the cell remains dormant, quiescent, in G0. Release these molecules and activate them, and the egg cells begin to mature. If the eggs mature prematurely, as it were, they are progressively lost over time. Even with hormonal stimulation, they may be depleted to start. Under such circumstances, the animal is infertile. Interestingly, this release from quiescence, or cellular sleep, and the consequent premature maturation can be targeted by a newly synthesized drug. This experimental molecule works, predictably, by blocking the cyclin CDK protein's activation. In principle, such a drug should be able to put human eggs back to sleep, potentially enabling higher success rates for IVF in certain groups of women with recalcitrant infertility. In 2010, a group of researchers at Stanford University School of Medicine took an even simpler approach to developing a toolbox for IVF that relies more intimately on the dynamics of the cell cycle. A perpetual frustration of medically assisted reproduction is that only 1 in 3 fertilized embryos reaches a stage where they are likely to generate viable fetuses. To increase the odds, multiple embryos are implanted, but that, in turn, leads to an increased frequency of twins and triplets, which carry their own medical and obstetric complications. Is it possible to identify one-cell zygotes that are most likely to give rise to healthy, mature embryos? Can one identify such zygotes prospectively? In other words, before implanting them, thereby increasing the success rate of a singleton human birth? The Stanford group took 242 human embryos and filmed their maturation from single-cell zygotes into hollow, multicellular embryonic balls called blastocysts, an early sign of a healthy, viable embryo. The blastocyst is made of two parts. Its outer shell gives rise to the placenta and the umbilical cord, the developing baby's support system, while the inner mass of cells, hanging onto the wall of the fluid-filled cavity, becomes the embryo. Both the outer shell and the inner mass form out of the first fertilized cell through the rapid division of cells, mitosis upon mitosis. The fact that only about 1/3 of single-cell embryos form blastocysts reflects the 1/3 success rate of IVF that is found clinically. By playing the film backward and using software to measure various parameters, the Stanford group identified just 3 factors that were predictive of future blastocyst formation: the duration of time that it takes the first cell to divide for the first time, the time between that first division and the second, and the synchronicity of the second and third mitosis. By relying on this trio of parameters, the odds of predicting blastocyst formation and subsequently the chance of viable implantation increased to 93%. Imagine IVF performed with a single embryo, no high-risk pregnancies with twins and triplets, and with a 90% success rate. We might also note bemusedly that it was precisely measurements such as these, synchronicity, mitotic time, and the fidelity of cell division, that had enabled Paul Nurse and his students to dissect the cell cycle in yeast cells nearly 3 decades earlier.